thank you in particular for mentioning the words from and pointing out that it has caused a lot of trouble for us, the Nishma part, because we all understand what Halakha asks of us differently, and particularly in the field of fertility medicine, the lack of consensus has caused a lot of agony among patients, which I will not get into deeply, but I see this every day. I do want to issue a disclosure, which is that I am not a rabbi, far from that. My viewpoints about certain things are influenced by my 32 years in practice, dealing only with infertility day and night, literally, and it does make an impression on you when you deal with people who are in emotional pain and beset by anxiety about never being able to resolve their situation. Today's symposium is about autonomy and I just want to say a word about autonomy. It means that patients should have a right to decide for themselves. It is, as Rabbi Tendler pointed out, one of the key principles of secular medical ethics, the others being beneficence and justice. Autonomy includes the right for a patient to make a wrong decision. So in where I trained at Belton Hospital, there were many Christian patients who refused to use blood products, even if it meant that they would die. And the law stands that if we have a life and death situation, that if we use a blood transfusion to save that person's life, that is considered assault, and it is, and the doctor can be prosecuted. So we have to respect patients' autonomy, but is there a limit? And that's one of the things that I'm going to talk about in this first case. So in December of 2018, I was consulted by a young woman in her mid-20s, and she wanted to get pregnant with artificial insemination. She wanted to get pregnant with artificial insemination using a donor. She lived in the vicinity of her parents. She was single and presented herself as very connected to her patients and coming from an Orthodox family. Wanted to, that although she was hoping to get married someday in the future, right now her priority was to just have a child. This is something that she's been thinking about for a long time. Gave it some thought, spoke with her parents. They were very supportive, according to her. And although she had not consulted with a rabbi, she was familiar with some of the halakhic concerns, and she knew that she'd be needing to use a non-Jewish donor. Her siblings were also supportive. I asked her a little bit about her sexual history. She considered herself a heterosexual, but was a virgin. I want to tell you a little bit about my own background. I was very very enlightened and excited by the birth of Louise Brown in 1978. I had just finished my first year of medical school, and the idea that a human being could be born after conception in a test tube was very interesting to me, and I realized that this is going to be a big problem for our community, and that was the beginning of my decision to go into the field of reproductive medicine. And for those of you who are not aware of this, in vitro fertilization had a lot of ban from the beginnings of the technique, and of course Halakha, being a living system, has now migrated to the point where there are almost no communities in Judaism that have a total ban on in vitro fertilization, although the line with which they draw the line does differ. But in this situation, I had been familiar with the writings of some rabbis on the issue of a single woman, no donor insemination, and it is and remains a top. I had actually published a long article about 10 or 15 years ago explaining that my job as the doctor is not to be the post-ex for my patients, and I treat many, many Orthodox patients all the way from the most Haredi communities all the way to open Orthodox. And they come with different requests different sakei halakha from their rabbanim. My job is to go with the sakei halakha that they bring from their individual rab, not to say something is asur or mutar. I had been familiar with opinions on donor insemination for single women all the way from Rabbi Shlomo Aviner, who absolutely forbade it, to Rabbi Yuval Chola, who is all the way on the left and saying it's fine. This particular woman actually sent me an article by Deborah Ross, which I had already been familiar, but she had done her homework in terms of knowing that some people did make a good argument for why this is okay. So when I saw her, I said, well, let's see what we're going to do. We approach this as it would any woman who's requesting a donor insemination for medical reasons. And so we did our initial battery of tests, and I asked her to bring her parents to the next visit when we would be talking about how to move forward with this case. She came to see me 2 months later in February of 2019, and I told her that all of the tests were favorable, including the test of her egg reserve. She had actually a high egg reserve for a 25-year-old woman, and I didn't think that there was any burning reason for her to ask to become pregnant at this young age and in this way. But I did send her for an anatomical survey to make sure that her fallopian tubes were normal and her uterus was normal. And that visit, she would visit our clinical psychologist who works with the Genesis team, and we would see what would happen. I was hoping, of course, that she would not pass muster with the psychologist, and maybe that would give me a little bit of leeway. She did also say that she was not planning to do this until the summertime. She had her personal reasons for that. And so we decided to schedule a revisit for the month of April. In between, the psychologist did clear her to move forward with donor insemination. I want to just break here and ask the rabbi for his comments on this issue. And then I will tell you how it was resolved.
Thank you very much, Dr. Grassi. Just want to acknowledge the Yeshiva University Student Medicalizing Society of Yeshiva College and Stern College. I have the privilege of teaching at Stern College. Just want to acknowledge Rabbi Glasser, Dr. Reichman, all those who are present as well, and as well as Moira Rebbe, Rabbi Dr. Tendler. I had the privilege of being a student of Rabbi Tendler, both in Torah and Halakha, microbiology. I assume you don't remember my grade. As well as bioethics, as well as halachomycin smitha. And if many of you still remember that Rabbi Tendler used to, every year, but occasionally at least, before Hanukkah, would take a bacterial strain of Serratia marcescens, which emits a reddish dye, reddish pigment, and plate it out on an agar plate, and it would grow, and then it would breed out before Hanukkah, Happy Hanukkah. also thank Dr. Grassi for inviting me many, many years ago when I was an intern, even before I was an intern, and as an intern, my mother used to participate in the first book, which was Be Fruitful and Multiply, which then evolved into Overcoming Infertility. Just want to begin by mentioning something from yesterday's parsha as well. The end of the parsha describes that God tells Moshe, it's called Moshe, that I have given you the Luchot Ba'evan, the tablets of stone, the Torah, the instruction of God's Torah, the Mitzvah, the commandments, Asher Kesafti, Mahorasom, that I have written. So that presumably refers to the Luchos. Nothing else was written at that time. So Meshe Chachma, in his commentary, suggests Asher Kesafti, Mahorasom, does not refer to Torah, doesn't refer to the Ten Commandments, doesn't refer to anything related directly to Torah. What it refers to, he says, is Asher Kesafti, the Sefer HaTeva Asher Yatzarti, Shezeh sefer shel Hashem yisbarach hayotzro. God says, I wrote a book of nature. I wrote the world. I created the world. In that world, I imprinted a nature, a teva, that is commensurate with and consistent with the Torah that I am giving you in the Luchos, the Ten Commandments. And as such, the two of them are not in disparity. The two of them work as a tandem. And whatever we can do within halakhic parameters of the Ten Commandments to be able to cultivate the world and nature and assist people in being able to be obedient and to adhere to Torah values, as well as benon lamakom between man and God, and also benon lachaver between man and man, as well as we know that there's a principle. The Lagom says there's also a realm not only between man and God, between man and man, but between benon laatzmo, an intra-personal relationship, which is also part of the mandate of the Torah. As such, I just want to begin by mentioning that the overwhelming consensus in the rabbinic authorities is that, in general, all aspects of assisted reproductive technologies are considered to not be mandated. There's no obligation. A couple, an individual, whatever the situation may be, should never believe or be of the assumption that one has an obligation to pursue in vitro fertilization for an infertile couple. There is no such halakhic mandate according to the overwhelming opinions of rabbinic authorities. That being said, however, because of the focus on the psychological, social, emotional aspects of the individual, there's a case that's described that a young man came to Rishon Zalman Orbach after being married for many years, and he and his wife underwent many modalities of treatment for their infertility, and there was a new treatment, I think at that time it was ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, that came out, and he wanted to know whether he and his wife are obligated to pursue it. So Shlomo Zalman said to him, there's no obligation to pursue any of these treatments. There's no obligation for that. However, he said, there is a commandment of Yisimach et Ishto, of basically making sure that one's wife, one's spouse, is happy and content. And based on that, it would be appropriate to pursue it. So that reflects the kind of deep insight that Shlomo Zalman had, that much of the halakhic discussion regarding assisted reproductive technologies, in addition to technical issues that certainly are pervasive and permeate the field, but equally as important and sometimes even more important are the psychological and social aspects that kind of guide persons or couples or individuals pursuit and therefore justification of at times. Grazi just described how comprehensively the psychosocial was evaluated in this individual, and that being of significance in any couple, and particularly this individual. In terms of, I'll defer to Dr. Grazi in terms of what the standard of care is. Just to make reference to the fact that the American Society for Reproductive Endocrinology, Reproductive Medicine, has a statement in terms of access of fertility to treatment by those who are unmarried, those who are gay, those who are lesbian. They have a committee opinion about that, and they talk about, as is relevant to Dr. Grazi, in terms of whether a physician has the right to refuse to treat such an individual or individuals or such a couple, perhaps that are same-sex couples. They talk about that, so I'll just defer that a moment. I just wanted to mention, as Dr. Grazi pointed out, the case of men, and in particular in assisted reproductive technologies. Dr. Grazi pointed out in the earlier days there was a tremendous kind of trepidation regarding permitting, and now almost unanimously folks can permit basic in vitro fertilization techniques. When it comes to the issue of a single woman, in regards to that, one should distinguish between a 25-year-old woman who still has many years of reproductive life to go, as opposed to a 38-year-old woman. We'll come back to a specific case after Dr. Grazi finishes his case. I just want to mention a specific case, if I may. But the basic approach in the postgame is that regarding this is a classic example of where the psychosocial and emotional aspects are the most important considerations. Let's leave out for this case, for the moment, that the donor would be a Jewish donor. Let's leave it out. Let's assume not like the situation in Eretz Yisrael, in the United Israel, in Israel, where the over a dozen sperm banks, there most of the term certainly come from Jews. Many of them come actually, some of the clinics really actually focus on former IDF soldiers as being sources of sperm banking in the Eretz Israel in Israel. Let's assume that the donor here, would be a non-Jewish sperm donor. That simplifies it to some extent. In that case, if one reviews the literature, one will find that finding an absolute, tangible, concrete restriction halakhically is difficult to find. There are many suggestions as to restrictions, but the primary emphasis in pro or con has to do with psychosocial issues. Psychosocial issues of the individual, and let's say a 38-year-old woman as opposed to a 25-year-old woman who really has a tremendous desire, natural desire, and a desire that is considered to be certainly appropriate and laudable to have a child, weighed against the psychosocial issues of the child in the future and what ramifications or implications may arise for such a child who doesn't have an identifiable father, who doesn't have a father who's present, doesn't have, again, it's not restricted to this situation, but it's perhaps more pronounced in this situation. And that's why the posthumous, for example, Rabbi Nachshon Klein, this says, as quoted in the wonderful Sefer by Steve Reichman, Rav Katzvi, so he writes that in response to the head of Pua in Israel, Rabbi Menachem Gorshin, that he writes that Kesheyula ben Kazeb, Kaseu Pusha, that when a child is born, there could be a kind of a clouding over this child of feeling uncomfortable, embarrassed, and somehow isolated. We'll see all the children in his family, in his school, or her family, or school, where they have cousins, where they have uncles, where they have grandparents, and this child is somewhat isolated from that, has a different upbringing, a different psychosocial environment being brought in, and that's a consideration. One can't say that that's an absolute halakhic restriction on a procedure. It's something to seriously consider when approaching this, just as Boskin described also, with the same degree of sensitivity, the feelings of the woman and her concerns and her feeling of being isolated as well from her friends, from her family, in terms of her not being a mother. Those are some of the issues that are discussed, and the two of them are somewhat in conflict with each other, but certainly reflect the notion of the psychosocial aspects. I'll leave the case to the end, if I may, and refer back to Dr. Grazi.
You've awakened a comment. The difference between the rabbi's analysis and the doctor's analysis is that if we use child welfare as a criterion in any patient, then doctors who do what I do would have to refuse couples all day long. Because we are confronted with couples who have lots of issues, not only financially and socially and educationally and physically, but we feel sometimes, I'm really worried about the kid that's going to come from this treatment, but that's not within our purview. That's not something that we can decide. But in this particular case, I have asked the patient to come back to see me after Pesach. That was last year, and maybe we would consider what to do since her wish was to begin in July. She did come to see me, and she did bring her parents, and in between, I had mulled over this obsessively, what I was going to do with this odd case, because we have had single women come in for donor insemination, Jewish women, non-Jewish women, and all of them have been approaching 40. And like the rabbi said, the cases that have been dealt with halakhically were typically women who were approaching that stage of life where their reproductive potential was waning and they were nervous about ever being successful. So I sat down with her and her parents, and I explained to them that this is something that doesn't bother me. Single women insemination, there are those who permitted, have looked at the analyses and I'm comfortable with it, but I'm not comfortable in doing that in a 25-year-old. And the reason that I gave not of medical ethics, but of medicine in general, which is first, do no harm. And what I told her is, you presented yourself as an Orthodox woman who wants to marry within the community, who wants to send your kids to school, who wants to eventually have an Orthodox life. If the success will happen, how are you going to find your shidduch? I think that if I go ahead and do this procedure, I certainly will be harming you. And her parents, I told her that if she wants to do it, the workup has been complete. She can go to another doctor in the area and without skipping a beat. Her parents started to cry. They said, thank you so much, we've been troubled. Remember, she said that they were supporting this idea. They said, we've been begging her not to do this. We've been telling her that she's going to destroy her life. We told her she has to be doing other things and concentrate on finding another shidduch. And we think it's a terrible idea. As a matter of fact, the mother disclosed that she's been in counseling for this, and that's all she ever talks about with the therapist is why her daughter is making this very destructive decision. Needless to say, the patient was not very happy about my bolting from this dilemma, and I received a very angry email the next day telling her that I've discriminated against her on the basis of her religion, etc., etc. So I wrote her a very nice letter back, and I gave her her records, and I referred her to one of five different fertility specialists in the area who would be happy to pick up the ball and do it whatever she decided, but that it wouldn't be me, because as a physician, I also have some autonomy, and I can't do things, and I've done a lot of things that are out of the box with a head chair from a couple of jobs, but I drew the line at this one.
So just to add, the case that I just wanted to share was a question that was posed by R.C. Reisman to Mordechai Ralbach, who's a member of the Beth Din of Tel Aviv.
You're still young.
He talks about a Rav Kavach Shloshim Shmoneh, a 38-year-old single woman who is part of the community and who feels in Connecticut, basically appears and participates in the synagogue every Shabbat. And one time out, after a period of time, she's been going there for many long period of time, and she's known to be single, then sometimes it becomes apparent that she is pregnant. So one of the halakhic bases that those who prohibit, and the majority of poskim do prohibit the IVF, assisted reproductive technologies for a single woman, they prohibited lechatchila, meaning that ideally it should not be done. That doesn't mean that if it is done, then there's a problem subsequent to that, but the lechatchila ideally it shouldn't. And one of the issues is the question of how marring one's own reputation. There's a concept that a woman is pregnant and we know that she's single, so then the assumption would be that she had an affair, or she had some kind of inappropriate or illicit relationship. Some people say that doesn't apply today because everybody knows that there are other avenues to become pregnant aside from engaging in illicit relationships. But as a result, the rabbi at the Beit Knesset verified what happened, and his question was the following. After the child grew up, the child was 7 years old, and the mother, who I don't know if she was still single at that time, but it doesn't indicate that she wanted to register her child in a Hebrew school, in a Jewish school. And the question was whether or not, so there became a debate in that community, which was in Los Angeles, that whether or not that child should be accepted. So my own reaction is, I don't see why there would be even a question. I'm happy that the rabbi did ask the question of Rabbi Ralbach, but I don't know why there would be a question regarding the child. If one of the concerns is psychosocial, then the worst thing we can do psychosocially for the child is to deprive the child of a Jewish education. Rabbi Ralbach responded that regarding El Kisher Lo Yudulam, they don't know who the donor is. So he responds to Rabbi Ralbach by saying essentially, that any Rashum in Yom Kabel Bin, I don't see any reason, impediment to accept the child in the two, on the rabbi. On the contrary, it's mitzvah, the karbo. It would be a religious mandate to engage the child, embrace the child, and the family, the whole. The mother, let's say, let's assume she's still single. And a Ludaiti, in my opinion, would be called Hammer, if anyone would want to distance such a child, Eina no hate midar kashal Torah, is conducting himself against the principles of Torah, which are directed out there in Noah, which is an important principle as well. That from a Jewish perspective, even if most rabbinic scholars would prohibit this particular activity, once done, that would not cast any aspersion on the woman after the fact or on the child. So that is keeping out the details of Jewish or non-Jewish donor, let's assume non-Jewish donor. That's something that I think should be applauded in terms of the Jewish literature, that such a child would be deaf. That was a different case, though. Dr. Grassi's case is clearly much different than the standard, and that why Dr. Grassi dug himself accordingly.
Thank you. We have decided that we need some time for Q&A, so I'm going to present another case, and hopefully we'll have some time afterwards to discuss. This is the case of a 29-year-old who consulted me in March of 2015. She had had four children, and she did not have infertility. What she had was a representation among her children who were 100% of the same sex. We used to say gender, but we can't say that. So she wanted to go through, she had four girls, and she wanted to go through a procedure that would guarantee her that when she becomes pregnant, she would have a boy. This is not a new issue in our clinic. We've had many requests. We have certain guidelines that inform us which patients are going to be treated in this way. For those of you who are not clear on the technique that's used in order to select the sex, let me just explain. So in vitro fertilization involves mixing a sperm and egg in the dish and creation of an embryo, which subsequently goes back to the womb of the mother-to-be. That's pretty simple. In 1991, the first case of checking the genetics of the embryo prior to replacing it into the woman's uterus was described, and that was described for genetic disease. And today, I don't think that there are any posting that disallow using the technique of genetic screening of embryos in order to eliminate the transmission of genetic disease. Anybody who's familiar with genetic disease in children knows that most of them are devastating and life-altering, not only for the parents, but also for the siblings that get born afterwards. So there's a great interest in keeping our community healthy. Doing sex selection involves taking a biopsy of the embryo. We remove a few cells from the embryo at around 5 or 6 days at what's called the blastocyst stage, and we're able to check the chromosomes. Checking and screening for chromosomal disorders is very common today, especially among older women, women who are in their late 30s or early 40s, because we use that to assess the viability of the embryos. By the time a woman reaches the age of about 36 or 37, half of the potential because of the chromosome abnormalities that occur as eggs age. So screening for chromosomes involves making sure that the biopsy specimen has 46 chromosomes, so 23 pairs, 23 on the mom, 23 on the dad. That's where we get all our genetic software. And as a byproduct of knowing the chromosome structure of the embryo, we can also tell if it has two X's and it's female, or an X and a Y and it's male. So we don't determine the sex of the embryo, we only discover the sex of the embryos. There are usually multiple embryos from which to take biopsies, and we'll know on that basis which embryos are male, which embryos are female, and then we will select either the male or the female depending on what the couple desires. Most couples who go through pre-implantation genetic testing for what's called aneuploidy or abnormal chromosomes, have the information about the sex before they become pregnant. The technique does not guarantee that a couple will have either a boy or a girl. What it guarantees is that if the woman does conceive from the embryo transfer, that the child to be born will be either a boy or a girl. We don't have control over whether or not that embryo will implant. That's why it's not called embryo implantation. It's just called embryo transfer. So she wanted to have this, and I had known that that there were posting who allowed this. But she went back to her rabbi, and her rabbi said, you can't do that. You don't have any medical problems to go through IVF, so it's asur. I spoke to that rabbi subsequently, and I said, how can you say it's asur? There are so many posting that do allow this. He said, no. I said, well, why don't you ask at that time, I'll tell you why I mentioned him. He had also speak with his secretary, and we'll tell you maybe something different. No, that didn't work. She spoke to another rabbi who was a little bit more knowledgeable in her community, who told her the same thing, you cannot do it. Now, the reason that I know that this cannot be the case is, by the way, you mentioned Rav Borstein, the head of Hanua, and he has a little article that he published about a case of a Yemenite man who came to him and said, I have four girls. Sorry, we do this to have girls too, but this is another case of sex trafficking. We have four girls. And I am the subject of jokes in my shul. And I really want to do this sex lecture, which I heard about. And unfortunately, I really didn't know. He presented the case to his posek, Mordechai Eliyahu. And Rabbi Eliyahu's answer immediately was, Teimanihu? Bikuach nefesh. And so we allowed the technique. But I must tell you, that I myself had visited with Chacham Ovadia about 10 years earlier, because the first case of a frum woman requesting this, she had come to me with six girls, I'm sorry. But I didn't know what to do. She had asked her rab, etc. So her rab came to me and said, I don't know what to do either. It happened that that I was traveling to Israel and I had some connection and I met with Chacham Ovadia myself. And I was with two Eidim. One of them was my son, who was in Yeshiva at the time, and also Rabbi Friedlander, who was the chaplain at my mommy's medical center, happened to be in Israel. And went with Chacham Ovadia and I presented the case and he said, lo, and I said, I just want to clarify, this is a case of a couple that have no medical need to do IVF. They only want to do it in order to select the sex of the baby so that they can have a boy. Law asur. Now, that didn't mean, by the way, law asur. It meant law asur. And they went on to have twin boys after that, and the rest is with his beracha. So I didn't really know what was going on. It happened to be that as this was happening, we had a scholar in residence at our Beit Knesset, Rabbi Avraham Steinberg, who you may know is not only Gadol, the Chochma, and is a Posek, and he's not really a Posek, but he's a doctor and head of the medical ethics committee at the Shari Tzedek. And I asked him, can we do this? He said, absolutely, we do it all the time. But actually, I said, we do that all the time. There's no issue with it. And they have to have at least four children. I said, well, can you get me a written pesach halacha? I need something in writing. He subsequently sent me a note from referencing Rav Asher Weiss, who said, absolutely, you can do this. And I said, I responded, may I show this to anybody? He said, yeah, you can show it to whoever you want. And so the idea of sex selection is something that's kind of weird if you're not in that realm. Just like doing anything for couples with infertility, it's kind of out of the box if you haven't experienced that situation yourself. People who have fertility problems, people who want to balance their families, they have special considerations. Obviously, they're very different emotionally, but we take them seriously. And this patient went on just a few months ago, had her second son that was derived from this technique. So it is very doable, and we have to be careful that we're not skewing the sex ratio in the country. We have to believe that the request for having girls is just as prevalent as the request for having boys.
Just want to reference that this particular issue is not unique to the Jewish community. Refer to another position paper of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine entitled Use of Reproductive Technology for Sex Selection for Non-Medical Reasons. Before talking about IVF, there is another technique, I believe not as as successful as IVF with pre-implantation genetic selection, genetic screening or genetic diagnosis for gender or sex, but the sperm sorting, where if a man produces a semen sample, sperm sample, the sperm can be differentiated in terms of those carrying X chromosome, those carrying Y chromosome. That in particular, Dr. Abraham, from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that itself is considered, then take, let's say, whichever specific sperm, and use those sperm perhaps inseminate through intrauterine insemination, rather so requiring in vitro fertilization. But then it goes to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who says that that's prohibited, because in that case, Shemash Kitim, Tazera, Mehamin Shina Ratsui, whichever selection is, that is causing Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's opinion a direct and of destruction of sperm, 50%, let's say, those that are either the male or the female, X or Y, depending on which are being selected for insemination, and that's Hashkat Zera. That Hashkat Zera was the primary impediment years ago in terms of permitting whether in vitro fertilization or artificial insemination, because of the concern of the man's wasting or destroying semen or sperm. So that's his concern there. In this case, if one uses in vitro fertilization, then there is no embryo or pre-embryo. And regarding that, the general consensus is, unlike the Catholic Church, for example, which in general is very restrictive regarding assisted reproductive technologies, whatever fulcrum we may have, the Catholic Church and the Pope, some edicts years ago, are much more stringent on assisted reproductive technologies, just to acknowledge the general approach of Judaism. But in terms of IVF, if one is going to use an IVF procedure and create embryos, so embryos, according to most posthumous, if there is an excess, if there are embryos that are stored in liquid nitrogen of a couple and they don't have to use them any longer, then the general consensus is they can be discarded. They can be used for research, they can be discarded, generally not, let's say, donated to another couple, but it can be, so that issue is not. All right, I just wanted to share. Okay, so I just wanted to share a similar case that's reported, another reported case that was requested from, there's a wonderful journal book called Bemarei HaBazak, put out by Eretz Canada, under the late kind of editorship of Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Lola Shalom. So the question was asked, this goes back about 19 years, the question was asked regarding an individual, Adam HaMishtadel, he and his wife have four daughters, perhaps the same case, and they want to have some. So it must be stated, I think categorically, that if the goal is to achieve the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Pru or Vu, namely to have that mitzvah fulfilled, which according to the consensus based on the Mishnayos, Gemaras, and Shulchan Aruch, would involve having a male child and a female child, which would be justification for having a female child if they have all male, then that's not considered to be a legitimate basis, according to many, because the mitzvah pru uvu does not require someone to use any kind of assisted reproductive technologies. There's no such mandate. So whether one would or wouldn't fulfill it, but I happen to have all daughters, so I'm biased. But nonetheless, the notion that pru or vu would be a legitimate impetus to allow it because they only have one type of child in terms of the children would not be basic, because even if one would fulfill this pru or vu that way, which we assume would be, that's not a mandate to do so, and it's not enough of a reason to do so. The psychosocial issues are different. So in this case, the question was posed regarding that, and the answer was, that is quoted here, that Rav HaPoskim quotes, there's an quote from Mordechai Eliyahu, which will come to a moment. Rav HaPoskim Yitiru, they permit the gender or sex selection, certainly for situations of preventing any kind of genetic transmissible disease, like hemophilia, is an example that's given. So if it's to prevent a transmissible disease that is perhaps sex-linked and X-linked, and therefore wanting to have female children versus male children, because if the woman is a carrier and one of her X chromosomes carries that, and then linked up with a Y chromosome male, then the child will manifest that disease. So certain genetic diseases are more prevalent amongst males, X-linked or sex-linked diseases. That would be a legitimate basis, but that's for a medical reason. Perhaps also if the couple is already undergoing IVF independently for infertility. But in the case of Mimprimatirim, Ema Hatirkiya come in. To establish the gender, according to many, would not be permissible. He quotes those who are against it. And then he does quote from Mordechai Eliyahu, Ph.D. Toshal Rav Nachman Borshin, who said, Enter number Achbarak Yachas Mazukim, it's a Chamishay Ladin. It's a five children. We show me, or another situation, a woman who's older. Therefore, the likelihood of having several more children is unlikely. The way he posted it, is it four?
Maybe he differentiated between the Jewish
and Muni or Ashkenazi. Okay.
Just
want
to get back to this.
Okay, I think we're a few minutes before the deadline, and we did have another case, but I think you'd like to open it up for just a short Q&A if anybody has a burning question.
Rossi, you didn't tell us what the psychological evaluation of the first case was. I'd like to know what your psychological team decided about this 25-year-old woman who came much in the chagrin of the parents with the request.
The typical psychological evaluation is explaining to the, first of all, going through the patient's history, making sure that that she's stable and that she understands the consequences of single motherhood, and she's accounted for all of the same, that she's able to take work and care for her child, and that there's no history in this particular woman of mental illness, et cetera, which there was not. I didn't feel comfortable with that level of vetting the patient. And I asked her during our last meeting, and I told her that I would consider changing my mind if she would go to a Frum psychologist and if she would get a note of approval. But she knew that that was not going to happen, and she refused.
Well, what about full psychological battery tests to see what's really going on? It's such a bizarre thing for a young religious woman to ask for.
The psychologist is a PhD psychologist working exclusively in the field of infertility with that clinic for over 20 years. She has her own way of doing it.
But that's not adequate in a case like this. I can be a psychiatrist, but it's not adequate for that kind of assessment, especially being part of the community that you are, to say, well, that's the way to do it.
And that is exactly the reason why I asked her to get another evaluation, but she was thinking that. Yes? The question about egg freezing, when we recommend that be done, I think the general consensus students now, is that somewhere in their early 30s is when we should consider that. There is a test to do of area reserve. There are women who will deplete their egg supply much quicker than others. And if you find somebody who at age 25 has a very low egg reserve, we know by the time she gets to her mid-30s that she's going to be in trouble reproductively. So we would certainly do egg freezing, recommend it as a matter of fact, in a situation like that. I must say that in a way, nature is much less there to women than to men, because there is that biological clock, and that's something that we need to be considering in any treatment that we give to any couple under any circumstances. Yes?
In terms of the harvesting, isn't that a sakana in some degree, what the woman has to do all the injections and what it does to her body? Medically, what does that do if you're otherwise healthy?
If you're otherwise healthy, the medications that we give to a woman who's freezing her eggs are all natural hormones, which it takes for about 10 days. They have been around for almost 60 years. I've personally given those medications to tens of thousands of women, and they've been studied upside down, left and right, as much as you can want in terms of their influence on the incidence of cancer and other diseases in the cancer as well, and there really is no connection. I know in people's minds they think they are, and when that comes up in consultation, we always discuss it. But yes, it's always, you can ask that question about any kind of treatment, because it's always more dangerous for a woman to be pregnant than not to be pregnant. So yes, there is sakana in something like that. But you know what? There's sakana in a lot of things that we do all the time. The chances of having damage from egg harvesting or in the order of dying in a car crash.
So just to reinforce that notion, that's why I believe that the protocols for transfer of embryos after in vitro fertilization that have been modified over the years, where now the standard is like two embryos generally, depending on the
two if you're older.
Right. So that it was close to what it used to be, where there were 3 to 4 to 5. So that partly because of the safety.
We have time for one more question. Yes?
It's not a question, but as the beneficiary of the technology, the Kofoni Hospital, 1994, had a daughter through their help. I just want to say that the miracle of birth is the miracle of birth, regardless of how it's achieved. That's it.
Okay.